Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Lob Podcast from These Football Times. On 29 December, Edson Arantes de Nascimento, known throughout the footballing world as Pelé, passed away aged 82. He began playing for Santos's club at just 15 years of age and debuted for the Brazil national team at 16. During his international career, he won three World Cups, 1958, 1962 and 1970, and is the only player ever to hold three World Cup winners' medals. He burst into the scene in the 1958 tournament as a precocious teenager, contributed to the 1962 triumph before injury denied him a place in the latter stages of the tournament, and then probably reached his crowning glory with the brilliant Seleção team that won the Mexico World Cup in 1970. He's also the joint top goalscorer for Brazil, with 72 goals in just 92 games. At club level, he was Santos's all-time top goalscorer, scoring an incredible 643 goals in 659 games, and led the club to the 1962 and 1963 Copa Libertadores and to the 1962 and 1963 International Intercontinental Cup. To many, he was the greatest player of all time, and the football world will never to be poorer without him. I'm Gary Thacker, and in this special edition of the podcast, accompanied by my friends Dave Bowler and Paul McParlan, who was the only one of the three of us to have the luxury of seeing the great man in the flesh, we're going to wander down football's memory lane to chat about the man who was probably football's first ever global superstar. Before I start, though, and introduce the guys, I'm going to set them both a task. I'm going to appoint them as manager of the Celestial FC, or the Heavenly 11, whatever you want to call them, for players who have passed on and are no longer with us. So with a squad of plenty to choose from, what I want them to do by the end of the podcast is to give me their front. We're going to play a 4-2-4. I know that's not the way it should be, but I can get four forwards in that way. So I want you to pick the four forwards who would be in the 11, Heavenly 11, with Pelé or without Pelé. We'll see that as we go along. So as I say, with me today, I've got Dave Bowler. Welcome aboard, Dave.
Good evening.
And Paul, as I say, Paul McParlan, who is, as I said, the only one of the three of us to actually see the great man in the flesh. So how are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing fine, Gary. Thanks for having me on the show this evening. And it's a strange time, isn't it? You know, it's been a strange year, this. And, you know, in terms of the Queen dying, Pelé dying, it's like two figures have been constant throughout my life have kind of disappeared. So it is kind of taking some adjustment to. And it's the day we all knew that was going to happen. But when it happens, it still hits you hard, doesn't it?
It certainly does, buddy. In both those cases, in fact, yeah. So what we're going to do to kick off is to ask each of you for your standout memory of Pelé. So, Paul, as I say, you were the only one of us to see him in the flesh. So I'll come to you first. What's your standout memory of the great man?
I think you probably know what I'm going to go for. I mean, I saw Pelé play at Goodison in the World Cup 1966. His first appearance there was on the 12th of July against Bulgaria. My dad got me tickets for all the group games all the way through to the semi-final. And, you know, everyone wanted to see Pelé. You know, me and all my school friends wanted to see him. But my dad's generation, kind of in the 30s then, they were desperate to see Pelé as well. And, you know, for younger listeners, you have to understand the context of the 1960s. You know, there was no global coverage. There was no YouTube where you could see the goals at random. Your only access to information was like reading Soccer Star every week, getting World Soccer Magazine, getting the Intercontinental Soccer Book for your Christmas presents. And that was the only way you could glean details about these players. So in some ways, you could argue that not seeing the players allows you to imagine them, whereas seeing the players takes that away to some extent. I don't know if that holds water or not, but certainly there was just this level of exoticism about A, Brazil, but B, Pelé coming to Merseyside and playing here in the World Cup. So on the day of the match, I'd bored all my school friends. I was going to the game. I think I was doing all my class going to the game, you know, all the way in the playground. We all want to be Pelé. We all want to kick the ball around. We all want to take the free kicks. And my overriding memory is, you know, being in the Glasgow's end on the terraces there, 52,000 people in Goodison Park. You know, unlike Wembley, tickets didn't have to be given away free for the opening game of the group. And it was incredible atmosphere. I was standing in the lower Gladys Street. Behind me in the stands, all the Brazil fans were there. And the noise they were making, it was just, you know, it's almost too difficult to describe how just... The phrase, the wow factor, is often overused, but it was just like, wow, what is going on here? Who are these people? What's all this drummers? What's all this melodic chanting and melodies and singing? And they're like, and my memory is from the start, when the players came out, and they took to me in that yellow top, they looked like gods. They absolutely did. And secondly, as well, you know, given that era in the 60s, it was probably the first time I'd seen a player of colour in the flesh department. Al Johansson, it was a real kind of shock to the system in some ways. And he just looked the part when he came out. And from his first touch, he was on the ball and he was getting followed round, hacked, cut down, chopped, bundled over with no protection from the referee. You know, unlike kind of the modern day, there was no rolling around, screaming, yelping. There was no running up to the referee and demanding that he take action against the defenders. He just got on with this. If you look at the clips now, a few times he's hacked down, he goes to shake the defender's hand, you know, pats him on the back, you know, and you're just in awe of his physical strength. On 14 minutes, another starving tackle on the edge of the goal area, free kick to Brazil, Pelé lines it up, it's straight at goal more or less, it's on YouTube if you want to catch up with it, and he just hits his venomous shot right into the corner nest, into Gladys Street, cue absolute bedlam. He's there, he's the world's best player. I'm 10, I'm in the stadium, and I've just seen Pelé score at Everton. Fantastic.
Tell you what, I mean, what a memory that must be. I'm a bit jealous. Dave, what about you? Were you a bit jealous? And what's your standout memory of Pelé? I know, obviously, it's probably a TV one like mine.
But after that, we can all go home now. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I've got two. I mean, one is nothing to do with football. So when I was about 15, he'd gone to New York Cosmos, and I sent a letter to New York Cosmos asking if they'd got any stickers or the kind of thing you do when you're 14, 15. And eventually I got this thing that came back, and there was a letter in it from signed your friend in football, Pelé, and a signed photo from so I mean, that was a pretty good day when that came. In terms of the football, it's art, but it's a failure, I suppose, after a fashion. It's that we talked about this in the World Cup podcast a few weeks ago. The dummy in the it's in the semi final, isn't it? And he go when the ball comes through, and he comes to meet the goalkeeper on the edge of the box, and he dummies the goalkeeper. The stadium moves about 10 yards to the left because you know the whole thing has gone. And then and there's something perfect about the fact that he didn't score somehow.
Yeah.
From that tight angle when he's chasing the ball down and cuffs it across the box, and there's a certain sort of beauty in the fact that it didn't go in. I don't know quite whether that makes any sense, but you know, as Paul was saying, it's the yellow shirts and the vibrancy of it all. Everything comes together, doesn't it? And Pelé is the embodiment of that 1970 team, I suppose. But it's all there.
You know, it's funny, Dave. I was going to mention that one as well. I've got another one as well, but I'll refer to it. But I'm currently writing a book about the Brazil 1970 World Cup, so I've watched that guy that thing so many times, and even now I know he's going to step over it, but you still almost go the wrong way. It's a pass from Tostão, and it's an injury time at the end of the game. Brazil won the game by then anyway. But what majesty! And I've actually said in the book, I can't remember the exact line, but words to the effect of something. With a cake like that, who needs a cherry on the top? You know, the goal is just prose after a bit of poetry. I'd agree with that. The other one I'd mentioned in the same tournament is the opening game against Czechoslovakia, when he tried to chip Ivo Victor from the halfway line. I know other people have done it, you know, since and scored, and his shot just drifted a bit wide, but nobody's done it in a World Cup before. I mean, you know, and so the audacity. To try such things. I mean, those two great moments. And I'll say, I would have picked the dummy against Uruguay as well. Yeah, a couple of great memories. It's interesting, you know, looking back across Pelé's career and comparing other players to him. The greatest stars of the world game always, well, not always, but often are number 10s, shall we say, in sort of shorthand term. You know, we've got the likes of Maradona, of course, Messi, Totti, Baggio, Zico. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure this is sort of a fair question, and you know, I don't think there's a definitive answer. But come to you first, Dave. Do you think Pelé almost defined the role of a number 10, the fantastic player, as they call him in Italy?
It's an interesting question. I've been thinking about this all day since you. At least you gave us advance notice of that one, as opposed to the front four. But I mean, in England, we never really talked about a number 10, did we, until, you know, comparatively recently, I suppose, the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. It's not something that we've talked about in this country, whereas lots and lots of teams in Europe, teams from South America, have always had that, I suppose we used to call them a playmaker.
Yeah.
There was ever much room for a playmaker in English football. But, I mean, in that sense, if you are talking about a playmaker, certainly it's difficult to think of anybody else that would define it in the same way. I'm always loath to say that because pre-Pelé, I mean, we'll come on to this later, I'm sure, but one of Pelé's greatest things was his timing. He came the television age. And we were able, you know, we can go on YouTube now and see all that footage, and you can't really do much of that with players from, you know, before that period. So, you know, I'm loath to say he was the first and the only one, but certainly in the modern game, TV era game, I think he was the one that set that kind of mark. But at the same time, more than being a playmaker, he was, you know, he was a great finisher. He was able to go and run past players, and I think that the greatness of Pelé is that he could do everything.
Yeah,
do absolutely everything. I was looking through some footage the last couple of days. You know, obviously it's been on YouTube and on the telly and stuff. You suddenly remember, oh yeah, he could head the ball like a proper centre forward. He could dribble past anybody like a George Best could do it. He could score goals from any distance. He club free kicks in from 25 yards. I think that's the greatness of him. And I'm loath to compare any other number 10s to him because it seems unfair on anybody else. But I think you're right. And I think it's a pity that, you know, we've all gone to squad numbers now.
Yeah.
In the game of football. I mean, obviously in the World Cup they were squad numbers anyway, but we've kind of lost that. I mean, you know, in England we all used to talk about the number nine.
Yeah.
Quite often though you'll see a centre forward that isn't a number nine, if they're playing with a centre forward, that is. And I think that's I know it's an old fogey argument, but it feels like we've lost something with that, with squad numbering rather than positional numbering. I think when you saw Pelé wearing a number 10 on his back, that meant something. I don't know that necessarily does mean the same kind of thing now.
Yeah, I tend to agree with him. The only guy I could think of who predates Pelé by a little bit, who was sort of semi-similar, would be Puskás. But he didn't necessarily play the same type of role, but... Paul, what do you think, buddy?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you and Dave have both said there, Gary. I mean, I think there's a certain symbolism about the number 10 shirt that's kind of got lost in the modern game. You can't imagine a situation these days, can you, where a player goes into who's just signed for a club, banging on the manager's desk, demand to be given the number 66 shirt or demand to be given the number 22 shirt. You just can't see it, can you? But there was something about the numbering from 1 to 11 where you knew the person wearing number 10 was the best person in that position, and that was why they were wearing the number 10. So there was a certain symbolism to that shirt as well. I think as Dave said as well, that it's kind of a... Kelly, to me, was kind of the first one I'd seen on Goodison, but then I saw the 70 World Cup on TV. And, you know, in the pre-YouTube days, he was kind of the first breakout global football star they got the chance to see. I think as well, in English football at the time, like the number 10 to me meant more the old inside left role, but not so much a playmaker. So you had likes of Dennis Law, Jimmy Greaves, who were excellent goal scorers, but they weren't playmakers particularly. And I think Pelé was the kind of he set the standard for what a playmaker should be like, because I think in the modern game, the playmaker is not necessarily a prolific goal scorer, but as both you and Dave reference there, Pelé had it all. He could score goals. I mean, if you look at the 1970 World Cup final, lots of people forget he scored the opening goal with his head to put Brazil ahead. You know, he could score from dead ball situations. He could run at defenders. He could do, you mentioned the Uruguay movements, Gary, before. He could take he could just bewilder the defender with the swiftness of his movements, by the quickness of his thoughts. And he was the complete footballer. And at a time when players with that level of skill, as you saw in 66, were offered scant protection by referees, his ability to withstand the heavy marking that without any protection from match officials, he's still the standard by which other people who are in that role have to be judged. If you have the other one, show us your medals, mate. Well, here's 3 World Cup medals, but that's good for starters.
yeah, it certainly would, mate, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, we sort of, the number 10 is a bit of a very loosely defined role. I mean, Pelé was almost like a second striker playing, not necessarily beyond Tostão, because Tostão was number 10 as well, but pushed forward because there's no way he was ousting Pelé from position, but he wanted to play, and obviously he played further forward, but drifted about a bit, almost like a false number 9 to create space for Pelé. But I think it's a role that's, I say, difficult to say he defined it, but he almost was almost the master craftsman in that sort of situation, you know, being the guy linked up. And now some people might argue that perhaps Gerson was the playmaker, the puppeteer in 1970. But as Dave said, you know, Pelé had it all. He could be a centre forward. You know, he scored brilliant goals. And he had an amazing leap. I mean, the header for the Banks' great save against England in 1970. I mean, the goal he scored in the final against Italy. I mean, I believe he's akin to the one, you know, Ronaldo's got now. He almost seems like a high jumper. So a tremendous athlete as well. Other subject of World Cups then, as we've just mentioned, he's got 3 winners medals. In 62 was a bit sort of a difficult tournament for him because he got injured in the group game against Czechoslovakia and missed the rest of the tournament, but obviously because he played still a medal. So I'm going to ask you guys to sort of muse for a few minutes onto which was his greatest triumph in, was it 58, as he came on as a precocious teenager, scored the winning goal against Wales, scored a hat-trick against the French and then 2 in the final. Or was it 1970 when perhaps he was a little bit past the peak of his powers? Come to you, Paul, first. What do you think, mate? 58 or 70?
I think you can make a convincing argument for both, depending on what your perspective is. But to me, it has to be 1958 for a number of reasons. I think I love the story that, you know, in 1950, Pelé asked his mum, why is my dad crying? And his mum said, well, because Brazil just lost the World Cup final. And he said to her, well, don't worry, Dad, I'll win the World Cup for us. Now, I mean, lots of kids say that. How many actually wants to achieve that, you know? So it's 1958. You know, and Brazil, you could argue, had still not recovered from the Maracanã, that was still hanging over them. They hadn't broke through on the world stage despite the array of talent they had at their disposal. And they only just scraped into the 50th World Cup as well. But they learned from previous experiences, so they wanted to do a preparation. And apparently, they did psychometric testing on the players before the World Cup to see how they'd adapt to these circumstances. And Pelé failed his psychometric test. He was identified as an individual who didn't have the responsibility to play in the team. It kind of later revealed the psychometric test was used for Sao Paulo bus drivers. So what kind of element to have for football? I've absolutely no idea.
tickets, please.
so whether that was in the manager's mind, though, I'm not quite sure. But he didn't play in the first 2 group games. And then in the group decider, some of the players had to go to the coach saying, look, you keep telling me how great all these opposition players are. We've got 2 players in our team who are better than anyone in these opposition teams. And you keep trying to fight them for these players. We've got Pelé and Garrincha. Pelé, he's got to play. And Pelé started next game against Russia. And there is a story that before the game, the Russian manager was told that Brazil will be fielding a couple of reserves in this group game. And he was delighted to think, oh, great, we're going to have an easy qualification here. Little did he realise one of the reserves was Pelé who came on. And then from that moment onwards, and I'm not 100% about this, but I think I may be correct. I'm pretty sure Eurovision was going in the late 1950s, so I'm sure quite a few of the games, if they weren't transmitted live, the highlights were shown that evening anyway. So it's the first chance to see this young, precocious 17-year-old. You know, these days, if he'd been Premier League player now, he'd done 4 periods on loan in League 2 before he got anywhere near the first team. But here he is at 17, given the chance to play for his country. Now, Also, bear in mind, slavery in Brazil was only abolished in 1888, 52 years before Pelé was born. So, you know, if you're a young black lad glowing under the favelas and you're watching Pelé representing your country, what does that do for aspiration? What does that do for your ambition? It's just the perfect role model. And also for the country, it's the role model of the new Brazil, the new forward-thinking progressive country. It's in the first, I think it's his first democratic government was in charge then in the 1950s. So it's all forward-thinking, it's all progressive. And then his displays, you know, in the matches, so in this, he scores the winning goal against Wales in the quarterfinals. In the semi-final, he's up against France with Juice Fontaine, who was the lead, ends up being the leading scorer of the World Cup. But that doesn't really matter because Pelé scores a hat-trick in the semi-final anyway. He outscores Juice Fontaine. And then he turns an absolute masterclass in the final itself. And his display is so exquisite that at the end of the game, the King of Sweden comes down to shake his hand personally at the end of the match. Now, you can imagine, you know, how that would have affected a 17-year-old. And even things like when he was when he's coming out the games at the end of matches, there'll be hordes of young, blonde Swedish women there waiting to meet him. It was sort of like George Best, about 7 years ahead of his time. They were scratching his skin to see if they could make it lighter. From their culture, they hadn't really seen a young black player. So on so many levels, the breakthrough of 1958 for me is just the one. He's so young. He's a role model for the underprivileged in his society. He's got exquisite skills. And it's just it was the breakthrough for Brazil. And then the modern Brazil that went on to win so many World Cups, you could say was formed that day. But the person who led that transformation was a 17-year-old kid called Pelé.
Compelling argument, Dave. Are you convinced or are you going to give me a case for 1970?
It's very difficult to argue with that, but I am going to try 1970 after all.
Good lad.
I think that everything that Paul said is entirely true. I think the thing with 1970 was it was more a personal renaissance of sort. I mean, after 66, when he got kicked out of the World Cup, he barely was never going to play in the World Cup again. And yeah, I mean, obviously that was a huge personal blow, huge national blow, obviously, that they got knocked out so early in 66, but then to him particularly being kicked out of the competition and very close to the World Cup. I mean, you'll know more about this, Gary, but he wasn't going to the World Cup. He wasn't in the squad. It was a comparatively late choice that he was going to go there, that he was going to play, and that he then made it into the squad. And you kind of, because he was so young when he did that, you kind of think, oh, well, he must be ancient by the time he gets to 1970, you know. And yet he's only, what, 29?
Yeah.
So he's not, you know, exactly decrepit, but people were talking about, oh, this is the last hurrah, and, you know. I mean, we've just had that with Messi, and he was, what, 7, 8 years older or something?
Yeah.
It's the last hurrah for Pelé, and he's got to, you know, he's probably past it, and he's not going to, you know, be the force that he was. And then all of those things from 1970 feature Pelé, really. All of those things that you think about, the dummy and the halfway line that we've just mentioned. There's that little control and pass to Jorginho for the goal against England. As you said earlier, there's the bank save from the header. There's the first goal in the final and that iconic celebration. And then there's the final goal. I mean, I remember the television pictures. And the ball comes to Pelé outside the base. He's set back a couple of yards to make a bit of space to get the pass. And it's like he's in the training exercise. He just knocks and you think, the man's gone mad. There's nobody there. And then there's this blur comes past and Carlos Alberto scores the greatest goal of all time. But everything that's in that World Cup is Pelé. Every indelible image, you know, the shaking hands with Bobby Moore at the end of the England game. Everything in that World Cup is Pelé. And that, for me, is why he's the greatest World Cup footballer that we've had. Because I think, it's something we'll come on to in a bit, but I think there's something specific about being a great World Cup footballer. And there's not been very many of them. There's not been very many who have actually owned a tournament. And I would still quibble with Messi actually owning a tournament, personally. But I know that's controversial now because you're not allowed to say those sorts of things. But, you know, I think he's one of very few players that's absolutely owned in his case, not one, but two tournaments. And that makes him the greatest World Cup player of all time.
Two completed arguments there. I mean, it's interesting Paul mentioned about the defeat they had against Uruguay in 1950, they had that horn to Brazil. It's probably a little matter of fact that actually Brazil's colours were originally all white. They didn't play in the Canaria shirt until after 1950. And when they played at Sweden in 1958 in the final, because obviously the Swedes wore yellow and blue as well, because that's their national colours, and they had the first... Brazil had registered their second kit as all white, but the players refused to wear it. And I can't remember the guy's name, but one of the coaches had to go out a couple of days before the final and buy a stack of blue T-shirts, coloured T-shirts, and the badges, the Brazil badges, were pinned on at the last minute. And they went on because the players refused to play. And there's an echo of that in 1970 because they played Uruguay in the semi-final. And all the press were going on about 1950 all over again. And when Uruguay scored, go ahead, the ghosts were sort of reappearing. And a lot of the players there say it was Pelé who kept them calm and said, you know, you've got to just keep playing, we'll be okay. I mean, to me, because I could see it live, I'd go with 1970. 1958, I mean, you didn't get the live pictures anyway, but to experience that majesty of such a player and as it happened, as it were, I'd have to go in 1970, but it's a cigarette paper between the two there, both amazing performances in World Cup tournaments. And so we're on the subject of World Cups. So, I mean, the question I want to ask you guys is the World Cup the truest test of greatness? You know, Dave mentioned just about the greatest World Cup player. You know, some players excel at club level but never hit the heights in the World Cup, the biggest tournament of all. And Ronaldo is a good example. Wonders in club football, but never won the World Cup, never been close. And Messi only just recently achieved that. And, you know, perhaps unlike Pelé, he was well past his best, you know, in his mid-30s. Now, Pelé's got three World Cup winners' medals. Three World Cup, not one, not two, but three. Does that raise him above everybody else as a World Cup player? Dave, go on.
Well, so I think he is the greatest World Cup player. I've been thinking about these arguments a lot over the last month, obviously with all the hoopla around Messi and so on. I mean, it's hard to take away greatness from a player because they happen to have been born in their own country, like George Best. I mean, George Best, one of the greatest, probably the greatest player I've ever seen in the flesh. I would still say George Best. And Northern Ireland were never going to get to a World Cup final, let's face it. Didn't even get to a World Cup. So, I mean, to exclude him from the argument, Johan Cruyff won World Cup, to exclude him from the argument as the greatest of all time is harsh, I think. But that's the biggest stage. That's where you have got it. Somebody makes the difference because, you're playing against the best in the world. You're in the team that's amongst the best in the world. And it's always really small moments, bits of genius that make that difference. And I think, you know, we saw, as Paul said in 58, you know, he made the difference to Brazil coming through. He made the difference in the final. We talked about 1970, making the difference left, right and centre. Significantly in England, where he was kicked out of it, Brazil hadn't, you know, didn't go through the group stage. And I think you can't really look beyond him. And as you say, three World Cup winners' medals. Who else has owned a World Cup the way that he owned two World Cup? Maradona, you can say for 86. You could argue Zidane, I suppose, perhaps for 98. I think, you know, for me, the successor to Pelé is Mbappe, because to me he's been the best player in two World Cups in a row. He should have been the player of the World Cup that's just gone, because to me, when it matters, just by force of his will, he'll change a game, which he did in the World Cup 4 years ago, and he certainly did it in the World Cup final, just by sheer force of will. And that's not taking anything away from Messi, who's obviously been a wonderful player, and you could argue the greatest of all time if you want to have that argument. But I don't think he ever quite wrestled a game away in that same fashion. He certainly did do it in World Cups previously, because he'd never won the World Cup and it was one disappointment after another. And I think, well as he played in this World Cup, Mbappe was the one that really was the guy who grabbed the game, grabbed the World Cup and said, this is mine. And that was what Pelé used to do. And I think in that sense, it is unfair to people who play for lesser nations in inverted commas. But I think life's not fair, is it really? So, so I think you do have to be, you do have to have done something fantastic in the World Cup to be that person.
Okay, yeah, I couldn't agree more, mate. Paul, is the World Cup the ultimate test of greatness of a player? And if so, is Pelé at the pinnacle?
I think the simple answer to both questions, to echo what Dave said there, is yes and yes. I think the World Cup is the ultimate test of a country and a team's ability. And also, it's the fact that, you know, it might not be taking place in your own country. You're with players you don't play with every week in your own league, with a manager you might not be familiar with. You've got 4 weeks on a training camp with individuals in your squad you might not hit it off with. There's all these additional pressures to just playing it like in the Champions League or playing in your domestic league. You know, Pelé's won 3 World Cups. You know, to me, that is possibly something that may never be achieved again. And going back to what Dave's saying there about Messi, you know, let's remember, Messi won his first World Cup at 35. Pelé was half his age when he won his World Cup. He was 17, half his age. Second point, Pelé didn't win any of his World Cups on a penalty shootout. You won it in normal time. You won it in the proper fashion. Because to me, you have to win the World Cup in normal time to me, rather than penalty. I don't see this, winning on penalties in a World Cup final is the same as winning in, you know, it, by scoring more than the opposition. But that's just a very old-fashioned view. I accept that. And I think, you know, just in terms of what that means, you're playing at the highest level of football. You're playing against the best quality opposition from the best footballing nations. You're playing in a condensed fixture schedule where so much can go wrong with injuries, illness, etc. And then to maintain that level of performance over that level of time, and then to cope with the pressure of getting to 3 World Cup finals as a team. I know he only played in 2 of them, but can you imagine the pressure on the 17-year-old? What that would have been going into a World Cup final. So, yeah, to me, it's still the ultimate test. And, okay, you know, I feel sorry for Ronaldo, you know, that he's never going to get to be a World Cup winner. But I'm sorry, he's nowhere near as good as Pelé. And it's just, what, you know, without coming across as being kind of a real old fogey here, during the World Cup, when Ronaldo claimed a goal and a flash on the screens, it means he's now overtaken Eusebio's goal scoring record for Portugal in the World Cup. And then I think, Eusebio got all his goals in one World Cup, mate. It didn't take him 5 World Cups to get to one World Cup. He got all his goals in. That's an absolute meaningless comparison. So just in terms of the Pelé, he scored in 2 World Cup finals. I mean, he's won the World Cup in 2 different continents. You know, by every metric, you know, that is the absolute pinnacle of footballing success. And he did it at the start of his career, and he did it at the end of his career. For 12 years, this guy's at the peak of his game, and there's no one can come close to him. So to me, it's the ultimate test of someone's ability. And, you know, if you've won 3 World Cups, then it's footballing mentality, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. If I were to ask you both to sort of to justify an argument that Pelé was the best ever, what evidence would you give, aside from the World Cup? I mean, I'm talking about abilities now, as his style, his playing skills. What would you put forward as being his strongest suit, as being the guy who that makes the difference? Paul, you first.
There's so many ways you can give Pelé the accolade of him being the best ever. You know, we mentioned the silverware, but, you know, we've also talked about his skill sets as a footballer, his phenomenal abilities on and off the ball as well. You referenced before, Gary, about, you know, the game against Uruguay when they were goal behind, the team could have folded with the power of superstition, but no, he keeps them focused, he gets them back into the game, they go on to win 4-2, progress to the next stage. So I think, and what's often underestimated about Pelé's career as well is, okay, he has this fabulous career in his own country. He scores goals, he creates goals, he's the first name on the team sheet every time. And then at the age of 35, when, you know, most players would be looking to maybe wind down a little bit, move into football pundits or coaching or something, he's approached by Henry Kissinger to join the New York Cosmos. So at the age of 35, USA wanting to start a league, and who do they go to straight away to be their star to launch the league? It's Pelé. There's nobody else. There's no other competition. And so, you know, for that judgment alone, that kind of shows you what an outstanding player he was. And then he's so influential in, I know the NSL was short-lived, but for the first 2 or 3 years of the NSL, it's rock and roll football, and Pelé's the lead singer. It just absolutely generates a huge level of interest in the country that had no huge attachment to football before. So I just think, you know, he's a role model, he's a footballer, he's incredibly talented footballer, and he's a modest guy. I mean, could you imagine Pelé jeering at the Dutch team if Brazil had beaten them in penalty shootouts in a World Cup competition? The guy acted with dignity, with class. I always think of Danny Blanchflower's quotes about football: the game is about glory. And Pelé embodied what glory was about. He plays in a glorious style, but he took defeat in the right manner. He never gloated, and he never tried to belittle opponents. He wasn't one of these players like Ronaldo who had fallout with the team and with the coach. He was a team player as well. And for such an outstanding individual to integrate his skills to the benefit of the team shows what a truly, truly player of the highest caliber he was.
Yeah, yeah. Dave, evidence for Pelé being the best player?
John, I'll give it with anything that Paul said. You mentioned Danny Blanchflower. That would have been some game if Northern Ireland had played Brazil. If they had Danny Blanchflower against Pelé, that would have been something. I think for me, that said before, he could do everything. He score goals, win tackles, make passes. You know. They talk a lot nowadays about seeing the pictures, because that's the coaching jargon of today. Well, he was seeing pictures long before anybody ever thought that was a thing that you had to do. And the great thing with his ability to see the pictures was he got a bigger and better imagination than anybody else. I think that was the difference. Again, you know, you come back to that shot from just inside his own half against Czechoslovakia, and David Coleman's, I was watching it earlier today, David Coleman, the commentary, well, now I've seen absolutely everything. Because nobody would ever have imagined doing anything as bizarre as that. But he did. It was, what, inches wide of the goal. And that, I think, is the great players have got that. They're like stand-up comedians somehow. They've got that ability to think on their feet. And everything is about wit and response and spontaneity and all that kind of stuff. And I think, I don't know that anybody has ever had that in greater quantities than Pelé had got it all the way through. You know, that famous third goal in the 58 World Cup final, taking it over his, you know, the lob and the taking it down and the just rushing it into the net. I mean, who the hell thinks of doing that? And at 17 in the World Cup final, nobody does would imagine doing that kind of thing. And that's that audacity, that vision, that it's a devilment sort of that does it. Except in this case, that devilment never spilled over, as Paul said, it never spilled over into anything nasty, the way that sometimes it did with George Best, or it sometimes did with Cruyff or Maradona. You know, there was never really, I don't know, apart from advertising Viagra, I don't think he ever lost his integrity at all. Really.
Fair comment, yeah. Yeah, I have to say, for me, I think probably the standout thing for me is, I mean, we talk about, you know, Maradona and Messi, Ronaldo, and we'll probably say the same about Mbappe to some extent, is that these were players who were stars and in a team where there weren't many other stars. I mean, there were some, yeah, but not many other stars. Well, as Pelé, in 1970 particularly, was a star in a team that was absolutely packed full of star players anyway. And to shine to be the shining light in a team so full of brilliant players. And the only comparison I can think of is perhaps Cruyff in 74, where the Dutch team had a sort of similar array of talent. But when you're in a great team, and Brazil's 1970 probably the greatest World Cup winning team in my humble opinion. And when you're the number one player in a team like that, I mean that's pretty compelling evidence. So, I mean, I guess the inevitable question, you know, and, you know, we're talking about a player who retired 50 years ago, you know, so there's people listening in, hopefully, who perhaps have only sort of vague memories of Pelé, or have only seen him on YouTube or old clips or documentaries about previous World Cups or whatever. And it's so difficult to compare players over eras, you know, we talked about, you know, 1958, and Puskas, and up to date, Mbappe, you mentioned, you know, and it's, you can't easily compare players across eras. But, you know, it's the impossible question coming to you guys. You know, is Pelé the best player ever? And if not, who would you rate above him? Dave, away you go, mate.
He's the greatest footballer of all time, without a question, I think, because he used to football what Muhammad Ali is to boxing, he's what Jack Nicklaus is to golf. There are certain people that transcend the sport that they're in, and Pelé certainly did that. And, you know, that is a reflection of his incredible ability, the reflection of that 17-year-old kid, 29-year-old man, doing the things that they did in those World Cup finals. But it's also a reflection of the exuberance of his personality on the pitch at that time, and then what he did later on, as Paul said, with, you know, with Cosmos and being a world ambassador for football and all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, he's one of those people, and I'm not just talking about his football now, but he was one of those people whose presence made the world a better place. And the world's not quite such a good place now as it was yesterday. Somehow. I think that, and does that make him the best player of all time? I don't know. He makes him the most important player of all time, certainly. The discussion about across eras is a really difficult one. Yeah, I think, you know, people say, no, it's more athletic, it's quicker, it's, you know, the things that they can do is log on a PlayStation and all that. And that's probably true. But if Pelé had the advantages of the nutrition and the training and the billiard pitches and the fact that people weren't attacking him with an axe every time he tried to get hold of the ball, then I think Pelé would be doing stuff now that, you know, would be put Messi in the shade. You know, you can only do what you can do in your era. But, you know, you look at those pitches that they used to play on, even in South America, where the weather is somewhat better than Stoke on a Tuesday night. And they're not the pitches that they play on now, are they? You know, they haven't got the training facilities that they've got now. Everything that's happened in terms of law changes since the likes of Pelé and Cruyff finished has made it easier for strikers. And rightly so, we've got rid of the tackle from behind and all that sort of stuff. So, if anything, he played in a much more difficult era to impress as a striker than it is today, I think. For all the defences are better today probably than they were then. The argument about the best footballer doesn't really matter. He's the greatest footballer of all time. There's no question about that, I don't think.
That's a brilliant point about the more robust attitude forwards in his era. That's a great point, Dave. Yeah, and he's, as you say, he's still showing despite that. But, Paul, same question to you, buddy. Is he the best ever?
Well, I totally concur with everything Dave said there as well. And particularly with reference to the physicality, you know, I think when you look at the modern game, you know, it's almost become a non-contact sport at times. And it really does frustrate me the way players roll around in agony trying to win free kicks and stuff like that, because the punishment the likes of Pelé took in his career was just unbelievable. And then it's also... it's really difficult to compare footballs across generations. It's really, really showing things that in 50 years' time, there'll be, you know, other guys on this here arguing about whether Messi was the best of all time compared to some player 50 years later. That's the beauty of football. That, and it's an argument you can never win one way or the other. You know, we're all products of our generation. We've all grown up with a certain view of football. We've all grown up with a certain idea of how football should be played. And, you know, on that kind of level, you know, if I'm designing my pair of footballer, has to be Pelé. And the points Dave's making there about the pitches, the training facilities, you know, can you imagine how good Pelé would have been if he'd had a specialist set-piece coach, for example, as he worked on the free kicks rather than just improvised them from game to game? It's just people to think of the possibilities there. Can you imagine how good he would have been in some of the coach of how to avoid Barkers, you know, how to avoid the tackles, all this sort of stuff. And then the power of recovery from injury, because the modern-day players can come back from quite serious injuries quite quickly. In the 60s, that wasn't the case. There could be some. It was quite easy to have a career-ending injury in the 60s, and you never came back to play a game again. And that was sitting on the back of players' minds at that time as well. I think what kind of convinces me, I've seen there's loads of quotes floating around at the moment about Pelé, from, you know, particularly from people who never saw him play, which I do find hugely amusing. But there's a quote from Ferenc Puskas, who says, "For me, the greatest footballer of all time was Alfredo Di Stéfano. However, to me, Pelle wasn't a footballer. He was above that. He can't get higher praise than that from Fenerbahce Porto, a guy who knows things too about football. And the quote from a poet who said, when the ball landed at Pelle's feet, football became poetry. I couldn't have written a better sentence myself, because that just kind of is it kind of conjures up the whole spirit of what an absolutely fantastic footballer this guy was. And I know we kind of referenced at the start, both you and Dave, about the lack of footage of some of the early Pelle years, and the quality of some of the footage really doesn't do the guy justice. There's not a huge amount of footage of the punditry you're talking 66 as well, but over on every kind of level. Yes, there's arguments for Maradona, there's arguments for Messi. In a few years' time, there'll be an argument for Mbappe. I totally agree there with what Dave says. There's arguments for Cook. And you can only judge those players by the standards that you held them to when you were growing up watching them for the first time. But in terms of who's left a lasting legacy in terms of football, to me, it has to be Pelle. And I think as well, I heard Tim Vickery being interviewed the other day, and he says, Pelle became the first global superstar before football was a global sport. And I thought that's a really good point, because at the time, really only two continents were the major powers of the World Cup, Europe and South America. And you know, Pelle surpassed that. He made football he turned football into a global game just by the sheer strength of his skill and personality.
Yeah, I love that quote, Paul. When the ball lands at Pelle's feet, football becomes poetry. I mean, that's a wonderful turn of phrase. Okay, guys, before we sort of wrap up, I'm going to sort of, you know, return to my poser that I gave you at the start of the pod. So, as manager of the Heavenly 11, who are your four forwards? You may or may not include Pelle, but, you know, given how we sort of eulogised about him, I guess he's got a fair chance of being included. So, I'm going to come to you first, Paul. Give me a four forwards, and I don't know, I'll sort of we'll see if we can sort of tease out why.
Yeah, well, it, as ever, when you pose these these questions to us, Gary, it takes a lot of consideration. You've also both masters are doing this as well, but yeah, okay. So Pelle's got to be in. So looking at a few other places, and you know, there's so many possibilities in the celestial team. I'd love to be the manager, because the bench is packed with superstars. You can make game changing substitutions during the match, knowing that whoever you bring it on, it's going to be a bit of a superstar replacement. So Pelle's definitely there. I was wondering, does Di Stefano get in there as well? Does Cruyff get in there as well? I can see a case for those. Dave mentioned George Best. Now, I know he never played the World Cup, but I'd have George Best, because he's, to me, one of the best players that I've ever seen. And you may or may not agree with this, Gary, but the young Jimmy Greaves at Chelsea, to me, was just an absolute phenomenon. And you know, he's somebody who could get into that team as well. Fenerbahce Puskas, I mean, come on, you know, the guy's a goal scoring machine. And then if I go back to the 66 World Cup, I've just got this dream combination of Pelle and Eusebio playing together as twin, as a playmaker and the forward. I just can't see any defence being able to cope with that. And then could you maybe, I don't know, maybe have Pelle playing alongside Paolo Rossi, the playmaker and the goal scorer, or even better, Pelle playing alongside Gerd Müller, another example of the playmaker and the goal scorer. So there's so many possibilities going on in my mind. Do I go back even further? Do I go back to the 1920s? Does Dixie Dean get in that team as still the leading goal scorer in English football? That's a possibility as well. So, and you know, even come closer to home, John Charles, what footballer he was. And he's got the added skill that if you need to switch him back to defence, he could do, because he can play both roles adequately as well. So there are just so many players there. It is absolutely impossible to pick a best four from that lot. But what I would say, two players who are in that starting lineup are Cruyff and Pelle. And then I'm really spoiled for choice for the others.
For the four forwards, you're down to about 73 options.
Yeah, yeah.
It's useful to see that you've actually got John Charles, who can play defence, and all the rest of forwards. That's, but yeah, I mean, you're right. I agree with all that you said. Dave, are you going to give me four, or are you going to give me another 73?
No, we'll just stick to four, I think. I'll probably each need a ball each as well. Pelle, obviously, is in there. I think Cruyff has to be in there. Just because of the, again, he was emblematic of a massive change in the way football was played. That 1974 Dutch team, and to an extent the way the West Germans played as well, when Netzer was playing for them in particular, changed the conception of football in a very, very short period of time in that early 70s. And Cruyff obviously was the emblem of it, the symbol of it. So Cruyff has to be in the team. I'm changing my mind as I'm talking, really. George Best has got to be in it because he's George Best. For all that, you know, I didn't grow up a Manchester United fan and so forth. He was George Best. There was nobody like George Best. And yeah, I mean, I saw him play two or three times. I saw him play when he basically packed up in 1975, I think it was, in a testimonial for Jeff Astle at the Hawthorns. And George obviously hadn't played for God knows how long, and he'd been in the pub for about 3 months before the game. And he was, you know, carrying about 4 stone overweight. And he was the best player on the pitch by an absolute mile because he was George Best. So he has to go in the team. And that leaves me with one more. And I think, just because I'm naturally Italian bias, I'll have Paolo Rossi. Paolo Rossi will be my last one because you need a proper out-and-out, no questions asked goal scorer. So he'll do. There we go.
I mean, that's fascinating because, I mean, I thought when I was sort of, you know, mulling this over in my mind as to how to phrase it, I mean, I thought we'd come up with 12 different players. But actually, I mean, I've got Pelé and Cruyff as well, so we've got a uniform team. That difference is I've got Garrincha playing on one flank and Maradona on the other side. And I don't think we need any defenders, in fairness, in any of our teams there, because, you know, they're going to sort of, if you score two, we're going to score 78. So, you know, there you go. Well, that's about it. It's been a great chatting about the history and the glory of such a brilliant player, one of the brightest stars, and if not the brightest star in football's firmament. I've enjoyed it, guys. Dave?
It's been good fun. It's been an education as well, as ever it is.
Cool.
It's been fantastic, Gareth. Thanks you for putting together such a fabulous script and giving us all a chance to put our points of view across as well. And I really feel as though we've done justice to Pelé. I really hope there's any younger listeners who haven't really seen Pelé that you go back, have a look at YouTube, see how good the guy was. And I just know tonight when I go to bed, I'm going to be dreaming constantly of picking the celestial forward line because there's so many possibilities we covered here this evening.
You know, I can feel a new podcast series coming.
Okay, it's a good one, that guy. It really is.
You know, okay. So, listening to the pod as much as we've had here, and I'll just leave you with one question that we discussed a few minutes ago: was Pelé the greatest of all time? If not, who would you place above him? We'd love to see your thoughts on Twitter. So if you can post your thoughts and just mention at these footy times as a tag, and if you hashtag Pelé, it'd be great to see the comments and we'll perhaps might review it in a week or so's time. So thanks for listening in, and we'll catch you next time on the Lob Podcast from These Football Times. Cheers.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.